From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins, in for Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump signed an executive order this morning that would allow people to band together to join cheaper, less regulated group health care plans. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, who rejected Trump's previous attempts to overhaul health care, said he was glad to be a part of this effort.
Today's a big day. President Trump is doing what I believe is the biggest free market reform of health care in a generation. This reform, if it works and goes as planned, will allow millions of people to get insurance across state lines at an inexpensive price.
Joining us now is Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Jeremy.
And this idea of allowing people to buy insurance across state lines is something Republicans have been talking about for a long time. Can you explain what exactly is happening as a result of this executive order?
Well, they tried to pass something back in 2005 that did pass the House that did not pass the Senate the following year. This essentially would allow groups of businesses to band together to be able to try to buy health insurance, the theory being that the larger you are, the more negotiating power you have. The problem here is that some of what's being talked about would not be subject to some of the rules and regulations of the Affordable Care Act, thereby making this care less, it would be less coverage. So I kind of likened it to if you go to a car dealership and you can still buy a car, but, you know, there's no seatbelts or there's no side view mirrors. It's still a car, but do you really want to drive it? And what it could eventually do, you know, for younger, healthier people, they may take the chance and that could pull them in more so than the people who actually need more care. And that would thereby drive up the insurance rates in the Obamacare exchanges where some of these older people, not even that old, but people who need – who just would use more care, they would wind up seeing their premiums go up. So it may not solve a problem that President Trump's looking to solve.
So there will be some that says this undercuts Obamacare or even is a deliberate attempt to sabotage it.
Absolutely. And this is not the first attempt to look at trying to undercut the Affordable Care Act. When you think about this, you think about not leaving exchanges open on Sundays, for example, so people can sign up online, threatening to withhold some of those subsidies that go to insurance companies to keep costs down. You know, the other side to this, though, is that conservatives have been pushing for this kind of thing for quite some time. Now, it's not a permanent fix. It's not a solution that has the same force and power of going through Congress. And because of that, like with President Obama, going through with DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals on immigration, this could wind up in the courts.
Domenico, what do you make of President Trump's tweets today about Puerto Rico? He's saying that the U.S. can't keep FEMA and first responders there forever and that Puerto Rico's crisis was of its own making.
Yeah, the own making kind of thing is a very curious thing to say to Puerto Ricans when they were dealing with two hurricanes that savaged the island back to back within short succession. You know, a lot of people pointed to Hurricane or Superstorm Sandy and said, well, with climate change, houses that are that close to the ocean are always going to be in harm's way now. You wouldn't have had probably two hurricanes of this kind of force and magnitude, some would argue, if it were not for changing climate. Houston, for example, wouldn't have the kind of flooding it had without the kind of urban sprawl that they've gone through and sort of set up perfectly for a situation like that. But President Trump didn't go and blame people in Houston for having a situation that they had to deal with and kind of blame it on them. I think the problem here for President Trump is that this is an optics thing. This is a really bad situation. And just like with healthcare not getting passed, he tried to blame Mitch McConnell. It seems that he's trying to say, well, you're not helping yourselves with your response here. This is not my fault. I've done everything I can, rather than taking a more caring approach about how to actually help fix the problem from a federal level.
That's Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor. Domenico, thank you.
You're welcome.
We're learning more about the deaths of four U.S. soldiers in West Africa last week. They were among roughly a dozen Army Special Forces on what was thought to be a routine mission in Niger. but they were ambushed. It was said to be a nightmare scenario. They were outgunned, under fire, and far from help. Thomas Gibbons Neff is a reporter for the New York Times and a former Marine. Thomas, first, American troops have been in West Africa for years, although we don't often hear about them. What are they doing there?
Right. So the U.S. troops in Niger, there's kind of two elements to it. There's a drone base there that basically looking for Al-Qaeda-affiliated militants, Islamic State-affiliated militants that have kind of grown up in the past couple of years. And then there's also kind of a special forces element, Army Special Forces, that are embedded with local troops, kind of building their ability to go out and conduct these kind of operations to go after militants that might come across the border from Mali or, you know, in their own country.
But on this mission, it was said to be a routine reconnaissance mission, October 4th. The Green Berets and their those who are attached to the unit did not expect danger. How do they gauge on a mission like that whether or not there might be hostile fire?
Right. So there's been a bunch of reports that have kind of circulated between, if the Green Berets didn't understand the threat, didn't know the threat, didn't plan for the threat accordingly. Yesterday, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, on his way to Florida, said that the militants in this area that came across the border or attacked these Green Berets were new to the area. So that's something that's still kind of developing. But, I mean, whenever you go out on a mission, it's called leaving the wire. Whenever you walk outside your base, there's a certain level of planning. What's the weather going to be? What is the human terrain, right? So are these people in the village going to be friendly to U.S. forces? Are they going to be hostile? Are they going to be ambivalent? So all this kind of goes in before you even step one foot outside your base.
And did that happen properly in this case?
The chain broke down somewhere. Where it broke down is unclear. It's tough to put blame on the Green Berets or put blame on whatever intelligence collecting apparatus is out there. But obviously, there was an element that was not accounted for, not seen. The enemy also has a say, right? So they could be moving extremely covertly.
And who did conduct the ambush? Who was on the other side?
Officials, again, have not come down concretely on who committed the attack. There's a Islamic State affiliate. There's Al-Qaeda militants who've kind of mixed in with other groups. It's a moving target right now.
Underlying this incident is a question about a standard that's called the golden hour in the military. This is not a Defense Department written mandate, but this is something that's taken for granted as kind of an ethical mandate that once you send troops out, you should be able to get them out of harm's way within 1 hour of an incident. In this case, American helicopters were not around in order to rescue these troops. That could have been the time lapse, a matter of life and death. There were French troops coming from Burkina Faso who did end up rescuing them. This golden hour apparently broke down in this case. Is there an overall problem with the concept of America being able to come to the aid of its troops that it sends out, especially in remote areas?
Right. I mean, so there's a lot of layers to this problem. The story that we wrote kind of looks at, West Africa and U.S. operations across the continent in general as being especially fraught, remote, limited resources, a heavy reliance on contract aircraft, right? So civilian contract pilots, right?
Meaning the military doesn't have enough of its own?
Right, exactly. Or is outsourcing that capability. The U.S. military has decided, right, that the threat in Africa, that infrastructure has not been put in place, or if, it's unclear if they're going to try and put something as robust as what you would see maybe in southern Afghanistan, where, the battlefield is 45 minutes away from two major trauma centers, or tries to be at least. So, in this case, Green Berets are especially trained. They have highly trained medics who can stabilize on the battlefield, who can, perform almost battlefield surgeon-like capabilities. But again, it's only going to do so much. And in the case of this ambush, we're still learning, right? Secretary Mattis said an attack aircraft got there within half an hour, but he would not say how long it took to evacuate the battlefield wounded and dead. It belies the question, is the risk worth the mission, right? If you're going to put American troops into these situations, do you have the ability to help them if they get in trouble?
And in this case, you're saying that they may be able to help them in Afghanistan and Iraq and have over the years, but in places like Western Africa, not so much.
Right. It's just it's a different mission. Each place where U.S. troops are deployed is a different conundrum, right? And, you know, this could be seen as an inflection point of, well, if this the threat is going to be increasing in these areas, then what is the U.S. military going to do to make sure that its troops are properly resourced to deal with it?
Thomas Gibbons Neff, reporter for The New York Times, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
High winds and dry conditions continue to fuel the wildfires sweeping through Northern California. At least 24 people have died, and an estimated 3,500 homes and businesses have been destroyed. The fires have displaced thousands of people, and authorities are trying to track down hundreds still missing. KQED's Suki Lewis reports from Sonoma County, where the death toll is now 14.
Sonoma County Sheriff Rob Giordano says officers are going down the list of the missing, name by name, doing detective work to try and find local residents who may be out of touch with their loved ones. While he says most of these people will probably be found with a few phone calls, in the coming days, he also expects the death toll to rise.
I have to. The devastation's enormous, and I imagine we can't even get into most of the areas. The 11 we found have been found for other reasons being in those areas. In other words, we're not doing searches to find them. We're getting called there for X, Y, or Z and finding them.
So Giordano says officers are beginning limited search and rescue operations in cold zones where active fires are out. But a definitive number of fatalities may still be a long ways off. 2 years ago, the destructive Valley Fire ripped through 70,000 acres of woodland and destroyed more than 1,200 homes in Lake County, a rural county just north of Sonoma. Four people were found dead. But a fifth man, 61-year-old Rob Lichman, was never found. Lake County Sheriff Sergeant Corey Paulich.
Basically, it's an open missing persons case.
In the days after the fire, investigators did an extensive search of the hills and woods around Lichman's home.
You know, with the extent of this fire and how fast it moved, it definitely could be something that could be foreseeable that someone may not be located, depending on what actions they took at the time of the fire.
Paulich says they don't know if Lichman died in the fire or not, but his friends and relatives haven't heard from him for 2 years. I'm Suki Lewis.
After the shooting in Las Vegas, there's been a renewed debate over gun control. It's still unclear if Congress will ban semi-automatic to automatic conversion kits, which the Las Vegas shooter used. But the debate over gun control in general has a long history in the U.S. And for a look back, we're joined by Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, welcome back.
Hey, Jeremy.
Hey, Jeremy.
And a lot of this comes down to the Second Amendment. So let's start there. When the founders wrote about the right to bear arms, Justice Ballow, Justice Connolly, what did they mean?
Well, you mentioned me first, so I will deliver my opinion, Jeremy. What they meant was what they said. They were talking in terms of a well-regulated militia. And what they cared about most was protecting this new nation from the number one threat. It wasn't people breaking into homes, and it wasn't terrorists. It was the danger of a tyrannical central government. Right. Now, they had just defeated a tyrannical central government called Great Britain, but they were very worried. Even these makers of the Constitution, especially when they wrote the Bill of Rights, they were very worried about the federal government, a central national government that might threaten the liberty of the states and localities.
Well, and it seems that the people who believe that the right to bear arms exists for the same reason today also believe that they could be facing a tyrannical central government.
There was also, though, another threat. Now, I won't dissent from my dear colleague, but I will add an addendum, right, which is
Come on, Nathan. Bring it on.
It's the concern about slave revolts, right? That is a huge piece of the mindset among legislators and concerns about running a democracy in the heart of a slave economy. And the concerns about gun ownership have a lot to do with whether or not slaves will wind up with certain firearms, whether or not slave revolts like the kind that Nat Turner helped to organize orchestrated in 1831, certainly like the kind that helped to liberate Haiti from French control in the late 18th century. All of that is coloring what becomes what we could argue is an early effort at gun control, where the sense of what it means to be a citizen is largely dictated about who gets to carry firearms and who doesn't.
And what was gun ownership like at that time?
Well, gun ownership was reasonably widespread, but guns themselves were not particularly effective.
Right.
And in fact, you really have to kind of fast forward to the Civil War until guns were mass produced in huge numbers. Mm-hmm. And they were guns that really could be used as aggressive weapons rather than kind of scatter shooting at quail, for instance.
Hmm. Right. And I noticed that the NRA was started in 1871, so right after the Civil War.
It was. And the NRA is basically a kind of early organization for helping people learn how to use guns properly. So they're working on improving marksmanship. There's certainly a concern about whether or not the country is ready to fend off a foreign invader by way of militias that basically know what they're doing with these weapons. But the Civil War
Nathan,
is all...
Nathan, I'm going to shock you and
yeah.
tell you that I got up to bar 9 on the marksmanship tally for the NRA. And I was an NRA member. I had to join when I went to summer camp. And it was all about learning how
right.
to use a gun.
I got
right,
my
right.
boater's license. That's about as far as I went. Summer camp.
My driver's license. No, it's true. But the other thing, Jeremy, about this period, the 1860s into the 1870s, is you begin to see yet another form of regulation, and that's black codes, which is a state-by-state regulation, again, of recently freed slaves banning African-Americans from the right to bear arms. And so if you can imagine, removing that weapon from their possession became a critical piece of making sure that they had and maintained their status as second-class citizens. And so the fact that that became a critical piece of what the immediate post-emancipation moment was about meant that once the 14th Amendment was passed, that became a critical piece of what citizenship meant for African Americans, protecting, again, those rights to bear arms through another constitutional act.
So when did people start talking about gun control, or what laid the foundation for the conversation that goes on now about
right.
gun control?
Well, I think there are a couple of precedents to the modern version of gun control. Nathan was right on the money in terms of saying, look, for certain people, primarily African Americans, there was always gun control. Mm-hmm. In 1938, the government passed the first national legislation that actually loosely regulated gun dealers and required very scattershot information on people buying guns and prohibited the sale of guns to people who had committed violent felonies. But in many ways, the story goes back to race, because in 1967, the Black Panthers appeared on the steps of the Capitol of California, where the legislature was meeting, and they walked in to the legislature carrying loaded weapons. They were eventually ushered out, but they were there to protest legislation that would have prohibited these very same Black Panthers who sought to protect citizens that were being harassed by the police. That legislation passed, in essence, to stop Black people carrying guns openly.
Right. And the attempt that they made to make a Second Amendment argument in the late 60s was also steeped in this earlier tradition that we outlined, right, which is about African-American gun ownership to basically remove the possibility of excess violence coming from other corners, be they civilian or from the state. And it's remarkable because this is one of those things, those continuums that connect someone like Ida B. Wells, who argued in the late 19th and early 20th century that the Winchester should have a place of honor in the Black home. Martin Luther King actually applied for a concealed carry permit in 1956 because of the threats against his life and his family. And the Panthers, many of whom were transplants from the Jim Crow South, either from their parents or themselves having migrated, argued again that this was something that they had learned really in the belly of Jim Crow, that the right to be well armed was a critical piece of their citizenship. And by one count, at least, some 90% of African Americans in the South that the Panthers had left behind owned guns of one kind or another. So this was both a political argument, but also an argument about their right to engage in their previous tradition of self-defense.
So let's move to today. I know you're historians, but you can talk about what's going on today as well. Why are we so awash in guns in this nation in 2017?
Well, I think, Jeremy, that there's history involved here, too. And it's the history of the last 20 years or so of this nation being at war. A lot of the guns, I went to a gun show a few years back for backstory, and I was just stunned at the number of guns that were military-style assault weapons. I talked to a guy, I guess I was drawn to the most historically oriented guy at the gun show, but he was selling old, late 19th century weapons, early 20th century weapons, and he'd gone to hundreds of shows. And I asked him how things had changed in the last 15 years. He said, one of the ways they've really changed is the demand for these military-style assault weapon kinds of things. And yeah, we can talk about guns, but I know that if you look at popular culture, especially in a rural area, I live out in the countryside, it's not just guns, they're there, but military-style vehicles and trucks, people wearing camouflage. I think the fact that the nation has been at war for 20 years is a very, very important factor.
That's Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Here in Boston, fans expect a lot from their teams and a lot from the reporters who cover them. I'm Boston Globe sports columnist Chris Gasper. I'm working with WBUR to bring you a new daily podcast, Season Ticket. I'll take fans with me for a behind-the-scenes look from the press box to the locker room and beyond. Season Ticket, available at WBUR.org/seasonticket or wherever you get your podcast. Funding provided by Zip, the smartest way to hire.
A panel of experts is meeting with the Food and Drug Administration today. The group is making a recommendation about whether the FDA should approve a medicine that could mark a milestone for gene therapy. The medicine is called Luxturna. It's designed to treat a rare form of childhood blindness. Adam Feuerstein has been following the story for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. He's with us now. Hello, Adam.
Hey, Lisa.
Could you tell us more about this form of childhood blindness?
This is a form of blindness. It's an inherited form of blindness that's caused by a mutation in a gene. It mostly afflicts kids, children, and young adults. And when this gene is mutated, it causes essentially a loss of functional vision. The best way to think about this is a severe nighttime blindness. These people cannot see at low levels of light like you and I can see.
So what this drug would do, and you quote somebody in your story as saying this, is it would provide kind of a genetic flashlight that helps patients see better at night. But it's not a cure, correct?
Well, that's right. So this is a gene therapy. So what they're doing here is they're taking a tiny slice of DNA and they are surgically inserting it into the eyes of these patients. And what that corrective DNA does is it essentially replaces the malfunctioning gene that's in the patient. So in this case, it's not technically curative because there are some patients with advanced disease who don't respond that well to Luxturna. But what you're seeing here is by replacing that defective gene with a healthy gene, the patients that do benefit have a significantly improved vision.
So that's a pretty amazing outcome. Something else amazing, though, about this drug is that it's expected to cost $1 million for one application. That's all a patient needs is one application in a lifetime. But $1 million is a pretty hefty price tag. The company Spark that makes the shot, why do they say it's worth that much?
Well, this is a very rare disease. So we're talking here in the United States probably a few hundred patients that would be amenable to this treatment. And when you have a rare disease, the price tag for those drugs that treat rare diseases is very high. We're commonly talking about prices in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Here we're talking about $1 million on $1 million medicine. That seems like a huge number, and it is. But what the company will say is that this is a one-time treatment. This is not a drug that you take on a daily or a weekly basis. You do this, and these patients have improved vision.
So the insurance companies, I guess, will have to decide whether or not the drug is worth it if it does get the FDA approval. But interestingly, the FDA doesn't look at the cost when it's considering whether or not to approve it. What does it look at?
That's right. In our system here in the United States, the FDA bases their approval of a drug on the efficacy and the safety that's found from clinical trials. They do not look at the price of a medicine in making a decision about whether something should be approved. So that pricing decision and whether or not it's going to get paid for is really kind of a something that's up to the patient's insurance companies and the company that's setting the price for that medicine.
If the medicine is approved by the FDA, how great a milestone is this for the future of gene therapy?
This is historic scientifically in the United States in that there are no gene therapies approved here right now. A couple of gene therapies have been approved in Europe, none in the United States. So Luxturna, if all goes well at this advisory panel and the FDA approves it, will be the first gene therapy sold in the United States. And that's a landmark. I mean, that's a historic precedent that will be set. Now, there are lots of other gene therapies, a lot of other companies developing gene therapies for different diseases that are underway right now. So, you know, this will be the first of what could be many.
Adam Feuerstein, Stats National Biotech Writer, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lisa.
President Trump is again railing against one of his favorite targets, the media. Yesterday, he tweeted that NBC News ran a made-up story on how he wanted a tenfold increase in the U.S. nuclear arsenal. With all the fake news coming out of NBC and the networks, he wrote, at what point is it appropriate to challenge their license? The tweet provoked condemnation, including from Republican Senator Ben Sasse, who asked if Trump was recanting his oath to preserve, protect, and defend the First Amendment. Joining us now is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And is the president serious? I mean, could the suggestion that news organizations have their licenses challenged go anywhere, keeping in mind that networks like NBC don't have the licenses, the stations do?
Well, a little bit like John McEnroe when he'd say, are you serious? You know, I think that Trump is both venting and working the refs. At the same time, it's troubling. NBC doesn't actually have a broadcast license to operate. The ones who get those licenses are NBC's local stations, some of which it owns, but most of which it does not. And those affiliates across the country each own their own broadcast licenses. So in a sense, it's an empty threat. In another sense, you know, it's worth remembering a little bit of history. During the Watergate era, the threat among many that the Washington Post took most seriously were threats by Nixon's allies inside government and out to challenge the broadcast license it held for TV stations that provided some meaningful revenue to them. And so these are pressure points for media companies. And, you know, if NBC were truly having things challenged across the country for its local stations, the network would feel the pain as well. What's more troubling to my mind in many ways is the idea that somehow that the president is not recognizing that the point of the free press as enshrined in the First Amendment is to raise issues of accountability that are often uncomfortable for government officials, and that he's giving cover for people abroad to authoritarian figures such as we've seen in Turkey in recent days.
And Russia.
In Russia, where you know, just in Turkey, a Wall Street Journal reporter was sentenced to, I believe it's 2 years and a month in jail for reporting on tensions with Kurdish separatists there. So, you know, what he's doing is undermining values here and abroad.
I want to ask you about another story that involves the news media. A lot of news organizations are under fire for potentially covering up stories about Harvey Weinstein's sexual misconduct. Here's Ronan Farrow answering MSNBC's Rachel Maddow on why he, a former NBC correspondent, didn't cover the story for the network.
You would have to ask NBC and NBC executives about the details of that story. I'm not going to comment on any news organization's story that they did or didn't run. I will say that over many years, many news organizations have circled this story and faced a great deal of pressure in doing so.
So what do NBC and NBC executives have to say about that?
You know, Farrow had been a host and a correspondent there and still has a relationship with NBC, but he's not exclusive to them. They say they came to him early in the process, early this year after he'd spent a few months working on this. They say they paid for much of his reporting and that it wasn't soup yet. He didn't have it yet. They didn't say that he had shown a pattern. He clearly bristles and bridled in that interview with Rachel Maddow, to NBC's credit, that occurred on MSNBC. But nonetheless, he bristles at the idea that the story wasn't reportable, and he felt that he did have things. Among the things he had was this tape done from essentially a sting operation arranged by the New York Police Department involving a young woman who alleged to them that she had been sexually assaulted effectively by Weinstein the night before. And on that tape, Weinstein acknowledges touching her breast without her consent. Right. And he says, it's just something I'd do. I won't do it again. And, you know, you would think that there have been far more meager investigative reports on network news than something that actually has a man on tape who's of great power in Hollywood acknowledging committing something that sounds an awful lot like a crime.
Well, other reporters like former New York Post editor Paula Frohlich claim that Harvey Weinstein called them personally to try to stop them from publishing explosive stories against him. How much power has Weinstein had over journalistic outlets? We know he's got a lot of power in Hollywood.
So there are two ways to think about it and two things you should know about how he operates. He's a guy who, from the many people I've spoken to in the last few days about their interactions with him, he's able to toggle seamlessly between being bullying and vindictive and being kind of wheedling, cajoling, persuasive and flattering. He can offer inducements to people. Used to be able to offer book contracts, although his book imprint has just been canceled by Hachette Publishing. He'd be able to offer, hey, we can option a movie. We have a role for you. You've got a great future here. This is appealing. Hollywood still has star power, right? And that kind of magnetic lure. And he would toggle back and forth between saying, I can destroy you in entertainment, to I can make you. And the other thing is, you know, he has the power that people choose to assign to him. People who want simply to be in that circle. You know, you watch President Obama, as I've had heard described by a couple journalists, at a speech he gave after leaving office. One of the first people he went to embrace on the rope line after was Harvey Weinstein. And it's a signal to people in political realms and financial realms and in journalism and elsewhere, Hollywood, that this is somebody who has kind of juice beyond his own immediate neighborhood. And it's a signal that maybe this guy is untouchable. So you have somebody who's able to pull strings. And if you're able to pull strings with not only just the people involved, but their bosses, you know, to reminded either subtly or unsubtly of the kinds of financial entanglements that their companies may have with him, then that's somebody who may have influence that transforms into a kind of power that transcends a reporter's ability to tell the truth. That amazing thing about the Paula Frohlich piece was, yeah, she was promised to publish her piece, and yet when it actually emerged online and in print, it was totally different than the way she had written it.
It's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thank you.
You bet.
Public services on Puerto Rico are slowly coming back 3 weeks after Hurricane Maria struck the island, but many people are still without power, clean water, and cell phone service. That has kept people isolated. Many still can't let family members elsewhere know that they're okay. Enter Vanu Inc. It's an American company that makes cellular base stations to help some of the billion people on the planet who don't have cell access get connected. The portable cell stations are being used now in rural Vermont and in Rwanda. Each station covers about a 3-mile radius and costs about $5,000. Vanu Inc. sent several stations to Puerto Rico and plans to ship 40 more, all for free. The equipment is connected to the ground to satellite dishes. They're provided by another company. The result is people finally get cell service. We asked founder and CEO Vanu Bose how the portable sites in Puerto Rico work.
It's a little box, you know, 11 by 12 by 4 inches. You attach an antenna to it, which you try to put up as high as you can. And then there's an Ethernet port on it. You plug it into the satellite dish. That connects back to our switch in Long Island that's hosted by one of our partner companies, Globecom Systems. And that's connected to all the different telecom operators.
Okay. So through your company, you're providing the cell base station, the cell itself, and you're providing the service. So how did you decide where this is going to go on the island?
That decision was made by the partner we got hooked up with on the ground, Global Dirt. They've now gone and identified 34 more locations that need coverage. So we are busy prepping 40 more units to get down there so we can light up other areas of the island. So there's a lot of place to cover.
That's pretty amazing how quickly that could happen.
I mean, kind of shocked us too.
Fast response. What was the first report you heard back on how this equipment was working, how it was being used?
Well, two reports. The first was from our global DIRT partners, who said it was amazing. As soon as they plugged it into the satellite, it was above a plaza on a town square. They said all of a sudden everybody started pulling their phones out because all the text messages from their families and relatives started coming through. And as he said, you don't need to announce that you've lit up service. People just start getting texts. But the most moving one was we got a tweet from someone in Puerto Rico. This is how I was able to contact my family. Thank you. That makes it all worthwhile right there.
The lifeline.
Yeah.
What's the reaction you have from your employees?
They are so thrilled and motivated. You know, as I mentioned, a lot of them came up and said, what can we do? And once we figured it out, two of them drove down at the drop of a hat to New Jersey, integrated stuff. We're there till 4 a.m. to tell you how excited they are about it. At 4 a.m. after working all day and integrating it, one of our engineers sent me a note just saying, thank you for letting me do this.
This is a for-profit company. You're in a period of transition right now. Has it in any way changed your own thoughts about the company or plans for the company, this experience?
Well, yeah. You know, one of the things you hear about in disaster relief is how long it takes to bring communications up. And what I've realized is the technology and the service infrastructure we built for rural coverage is ideally suited to rapidly bring up emergency services. So, you know, we're focused on getting more systems down to Puerto Rico now, but as soon as we can take a breath, I'm going to think about how can we make this part of our business so that we can rapidly deploy an emergency, and not just around the U.S., anywhere in the globe. We're deployed in India. We're deployed in Africa. We should be able to support disasters there as well. And I'm looking forward to get a minute to think about that.
Fanu Bose, thank you. I'll give you that minute now.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Our next two guests have just finished pulling a giant pen through 400 miles of wilderness in Utah, Wyoming, and Colorado. They are the German artists Wolfgang Eichner and Thomas Huber. Their project is called Linear, and it took them 3 weeks to complete. They're now with us from Salt Lake City. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How big is the pen, by the way?
Oh, the pen is 4 meters. It's hard to convert for us. Yes, it's made of a foam, special foam, and it's got a glossy surface, and it's probably about 30 pounds.
Yeah, it's very lightweight and silvery shiny.
And how difficult is it to drag across the desert?
Oh, it's quite difficult sometimes. We had three different types to carry our pen. The first one was like a backpack.
But the pin or the little wheel on the end was on the ground for drawing the line.
So this was for rough wilderness. And if we had some tracks or trails, we used our trolley so we could drag it by hand. And the last version was the bike version. So we put the trolley behind the bike and dragged it on road.
That was the high-speed version.
It was the high-speed version. Mm.
And did you actually leave a line like you would if you were pulling a real pen along the ground?
There wasn't any pigment or ink or something involved. It was a symbolic action like drawing a line on the ground, but the perception nowadays is not only in reality one, it's also in reality two in the internet. And therefore, Thomas created a home page where the viewer can follow the line, how it was created, and photographs, video clips.
So how did people perceive it? How many people did you run into along your journey?
More than we thought.
Yes, even in the desert. For example, met the Sweetwater County Sheriff, who was a real nice guy, and we met people who offered us a beer and asking what crazy pen this might be. But all people have been very, very friendly, and they've been very interested in what we are doing.
And yeah. What did you tell them about what you're doing? What did you tell them about why you're doing it?
I think we told everybody a different story. kind of. Yeah, it's so crazy. A man in a suit with this huge pen above him it's asking for being a metaphor, but nobody can be really sure what it means, and that's what fascinates us.
So we told people mostly we have a very big pen and we're doing a very big line, so using the landscape as a very big sheet of paper.
Did you come across any animals?
We saw a few coyotes. That was nice.
And one very big eagle right next to us.
But they didn't give you a second look because of the huge pen that you were carrying?
The cows did, I guess. The cows, we met a lot of cows and horses, and they've been pretty curious.
Yeah, they came closer even.
And again, why a pen?
Why a pen? It's a classic. The pen is a very important tool in human culture. And now it's on the step of being useless because of the digital world. But that's not really the point why we made the work of art.
So what is the point?
What is the point about the pen? It's not the pen as such. It is the arrogance of human nature, thinking that drawing straight lines, simplifying things, makes the world understandable.
So the pen is a symbol for this. And as we are painters, artists, drawers, we use a pen almost every day. So it's our tool.
The straight line, of course, relates here in the area to the also imaginary straight lines, the border lines that do exist, but they are not visible.
Why did you do this in the U.S. and not in Germany, since you're both German?
Yeah, we don't have straight border lines there.
Yeah, we've been thinking a lot about, if you have a look at the map, especially the western states of the U.S., you can find these straight lines all over. For us, they are kind of crazy. Just making a straight line over hundreds of miles and saying this is the borderline between, let me say, Utah and Wyoming. So we really like this picture for our project to do another straight line, not only virtually, but in reality.
That's Wolfgang Eichner and Thomas Huber, who are artists that just completed their project Linear, which involved pulling a giant pen through Utah, Wyoming, and Colorado. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, too.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. Robin Young is back tomorrow. This is Here Now.